stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome again to Call to Communion on this Tuesday afternoon. Glad that you could join us. We have a wonderful vehicle for those of you who are not Catholic to get your questions answered about the Catholic faith. Maybe you've got a question about Mary, for example, or about confession, or about Holy Communion. Maybe you've got a question about purgatory, and you're not quite sure where to get the answers. You know, beware of anything out there on the internet, except for EWTN, of course. Why not give us a call? Let's get that question answered today. Here's our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Outside North America, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 58177. Wait for our response. Once you get it, text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. And of course, you can always send us an email. ctc@ewtn.com is the address. Pedro Quiles, our producer, Michael McCall on the phones, Rich Jesse handling social media. If you'd like to ask a question via YouTube or Facebook. We're streaming on both those platforms right now. Just put your question in the comments box, if you would, please, and then we'll get that here in the studio. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
I am well. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing decent, thank you.
Very timely question here to lead us off. This is from Justin. What is the Catholic response to the New Age spiritualism that seems to be everywhere these days?
Not to do it. not a fan.
Okay.
Not a fan.
All right.
I'm not an expert in New Age spirituality, so what I say is very impressionistic. What I've seen just growing up in the United States is that New Age spirituality is very much about a desire to bend reality to do my will, basically. Mm. I want to be titillated. I want something to excite me. There are cultic practices like seeking mediums and spiritists, the belief that immaterial objects can do the heavy lifting for me in my interior spiritual transformation. I remember when I was in high school, I heard a New Age enthusiast give a lecture on the quasi-magical properties of crystals, crystals are, something that you can grow in a lab that might look good on a girl's finger, but otherwise are fairly inert in terms of having any sort of transformative effect on human consciousness. And, all of this proceeds from, an unwillingness to engage in the hard work of self-examination and moral transformation and rooting out of our personality the things that that really impede us in our own flourishing. All of us have self-destructive and self-deceptive tendencies, and the ability to recognize that and take the hard steps necessary to try to change is not very pleasant. And so the idea that some disembodied spirit from another world, some alien invader, some crystal magic ring could do that heavy lifting for me, while simultaneously telling me that I'm a god or maybe the reincarnation of some Egyptian princess, who intrinsically deserves to be adored by millions and that I'm destined to, rebirthed as some kind of, paparazzi loved celebrity.
Yeah.
Has a kind of visceral appeal, but does like very little in the way of spiritual enlightenment. And in that regard, New Age is, some of it is rehashed Eastern spirituality, but without any of the Eastern virtues.
Mm.
In classical Indian thought, reincarnation was never seen as an opportunity to be reborn as, Madonna or something. It was always something to be eschewed, something that somebody wanted to escape, because the underlying conviction was attachment to this world and to the passions and lusts and pleasures and pride of this existence are ultra illusory and unsatisfying. Mm-hmm. And so, once one wants to practice ascetical discipline, disciplines and meditation or whatnot to escape that. And so what the New Age people did is they just took reincarnation and dropped the rest of it. They dropped all the good Eastern ethics for the superstitious cosmology and then wrapped it around a basically sort of Hollywood light version of American consumerism. And I don't think you have to be a Catholic to recognize that that's fairly shallow and unsatisfying, right?
Yeah.
And the Catholic faith says that our fundamental dilemma is a moral one. And, you know, Paul talks about loving the law of God and the good, mm-hmm. you know, with part of himself, but finding it difficult to accomplish and the need to overcome ourselves and to, you know, the arduous work of loving our neighbor and being humble and seeing through illusion takes a lot of self-examination, a lot of confession of faults, a lot of asking for forgiveness, a lot of reconciliation, a lot of reaching out to people that I might not otherwise want to reach out with, and mm-hmm. doesn't require aspiring after, you know, I don't know, being reborn as some sort of Egyptian princess.
The words watery tart come to mind.
Watery tart, yes.
Does the church, the Catholic Church, actually address this head on anywhere, perhaps in the catechism?
The catechism definitely addresses individual practices like divination and sorcery and mediums and spiritists and astrology, uh-huh. that, and condemns all of them. Uh-huh. You'll find some guidance from the magisterium on prayer practices and spirituality. I mean, Cardinal Ratzinger, when he was head of the CDF, published a document, in, I think the late 80s, called Some Aspects of Christian Meditation, warning about sort of improper appropriation of non-Christian spiritualities into the Christian faith when they otherwise would conflict with fundamental Christian convictions. I think E.W. Tin's very own Mitch Pacwa, didn't he publish a book in our catalog on Catholics in the New Age?
So, yeah.
And he had kind of an inside view because I think at one time he ran around with some Catholic types that were kind of getting into that, and then he realized, no, that's a dead end. We're not going there. And he wrote a good book on it. So get a hold of the EWTN Religious Catalog. Look up Father Mitch's book.
Thank you, Justin, for your question. Another great resource would be our own program, Women of Grace, with John Ed Williams. I know that every Wednesday they tackle some of these under the banner of Wacky Wednesday.
Wacky Wednesday.
And, well, there's a good reason for that because some of these do tend to be a little bit wacky. So do check that out, Justin. I think it's going to be a great resource for you. All right, we're going to get to the phones in a moment here. We will hopefully talk with you today at 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for Dr. David Anders, maybe you'd like to share with us what is stopping you from becoming a Catholic. Ho, ho. 833-288-3986. Call to Communion on this Tuesday afternoon here on EWTN. Do stay with us. Hey, glad you're with us for Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on this Tuesday afternoon here on EWTN. Lines are open for you at 833-288-EWTN. When you call us, you'll be talking with Michael McCall, our call screener today. He will get you squared away and hopefully get your call on the air right away. 833-288-3986. Here's a great book to check out from EWTN Publishing. If you want peace in this life, The Spiritual Letters of Venerable Bruno Lanteri. It's by Father Timothy Gallagher. He delves into the spirituality of Bruno Lanteri, known as a great spiritual director. In this treasure trove of letters that he wrote to his spiritual children, discover how Venerable Bruno can help you overcome spiritual discouragement with his straightforward and practical counsels. That, paired with Father Gallagher's reflections and the writings of the saints, you'll gain confidence in God and greater patience with yourself. I think we all need that from time to time. If you want peace in this life, The Spiritual Letters of Venerable Bruno Lanteri by Father Timothy Gallagher. It's available now from EWTN's religious catalog. Buy Catholic, shop EWTNRC.com. Buy Catholic, shop EWTNRC.com. All right, here's an email from Alex now. When Jesus was in the desert, did he fast for 40 days, or was that just an expression?
So the text says he fasted for 40 days.
Okay.
I have, now obviously, 40 days in the desert is a highly symbolic behavior because it's evoking the 40 years in the desert that Israel sojourned on the way to the Promised Land. It's presaging, Moses's ascent to Mount Carmel. I mean, there's so many. It presages or it evokes Elijah's running without stopping for 40 days and nights to Mount Horeb. You know, after he was chased away by Jezebel after killing the prophets of Baal. I mean, this is a 40 days is a sort of archetypical period of time for someone to go out into the wilderness and engage in order to meet God. I mean, if you're going to be an Israelite prophet, you're going to have to go away 40 days at some point in time, right? Exactly, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think this is what Christ did. Now, it can be both and. It can be an historical 40-day period of fasting that is also replete with figurative and allegorical and symbolic significance. I don't think there's any reason to make that a dichotomy where it has to be one or the other.
Yeah. Okay. And appreciate that. Thank you so much, Alex, for your email. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Lines are open for you at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Interesting one here from Jerry. How common was it for someone like the Blessed Mother to have made a vow of virginity and yet still be betrothed?
Not common.
Not common at all?
Not common. Don't think we know another instance of that from antiquity.
And also, did Joseph go into this knowing it would be a celibate relationship?
Well, he would have had to have.
Okay. Yeah.
Otherwise, the Blessed Virgin Mary would have been kind of dealing him a raw deal, right?
Sure.
That had to be an agreement about that, yeah. Which is why some of the church fathers thought that Joseph was actually an older fellow who might even have been married before and widowed. And so one of the explanations, not the one I hold, but one of the explanations that you will hear in the fathers for who the brothers of our Lord were stepbrothers that would have been through Joseph and the previous marriage. So, yeah,
I mean,
you don't have to hold that, but that's a theory that some of the fathers held, yeah.
Jerry, thanks so much for your email. Here's one from Helen. My cousin was recently converted to Seventh-day Adventism. How can I talk to him about the differences between Christianity and Seventh-day Adventism?
Well, so there's two questions here. One is, what are the differences? And two, how do you talk to him?
Okay.
The first one's easier to answer than the second one, right? And Seventh-day Adventism is comes out of the 19th century American revivalist religious context and apocalypticism, end of the world speculation. And it was kind of a passion in 19th century America to start a denomination and claim that you and you alone had finally discovered the key that unlocked the door to Christianity, and you could explain why there were denominations and why things didn't look so good. And you had finally gotten back to the beginning and gotten all figured out. Everybody and his brother was doing this. And they all came up with different theories,
So
Seventh-day Adventism and the Jehovah's Witnesses and the Mormon Church and, you know, not to mention sort of more mainstream developments like the Wesleyan Holiness Movement and various revivalist movements. I mean, the Campbellite movement of the Churches of Christ. I mean, there's just so many. There was just a passion for going out into the hills and, aha, eureka, I found it. Everybody else is wrong, and I alone am right. Everybody was doing this, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And Ellen White of the Seventh-day Adventists had this kind of an experience, and she believed she'd sort of unlocked the key. And so there's a bunch of anti-Catholicism tied up in her theory. A lot of end-of-the-world speculation, and then most conspicuously, an insistence on following more of the laws of the Old Testament regarding Jewish identity, in particular what they wrongly take to be a mandate for seventh-day worship. There's actually no mandate in the Old Testament to worship God on the seventh day. The Old Testament required the Jews to refrain from work on the seventh day. There's nothing that specifically hallows the seventh day as a day of worship. In fact, sacrifice in the temple was something that took place every day, right? And so it's based on a misunderstanding of Old Testament law, but nevertheless, that was her position.
Okay.
And then interestingly, some adherence to Old Testament dietary laws. And so I'm not a huge big fan of Seventh-day Adventism personally. It has no appeal to me. But one of the things that I admire about them is that they tend to eat healthy. And I like to eat healthy. It's a big thing for me.
Yes.
Kind of the geographic heartland of Seventh-day Adventism is Loma Linda, California.
Really?
Yep. And if you look at studies of the so-called blue zones, these regions of the world where you find a greater than average number of centenarians, and so you'll find places like Sardinia, Okinawa, there's some other Mediterranean states, and then Loma Linda, California.
Wow.
And what they all tend to have in common is they eat lots of vegetables.
Hmm.
They eat lots of vegetables and not so heavy on the meats. And so they have lower rates of heart disease and cancer and so forth. So I think that's kind of cool about some of the Adventists that eat healthy. You know, they also have a kind of respect for the natural law tradition, which is a Catholic thing. We also have a respect for the natural law tradition. So there are some points of commonality. So I guess if I were going to begin a dialogue with a Seventh-day Adventist, I wouldn't want to start in a way that was designed to offend. You know, I guess I'd probably be more into looking for points of commonality. So for me, I'd be like, dude, let's talk about healthy eating and natural law, right? Because that's something that I would personally have in common with some of the Adventists. And I'd be like, you know that business about how y'all hate the Pope? Maybe we should stay off of that one for right now.
We'll work up to that.
We'll work up to that, exactly.
Helen, thanks so much for your email. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Still time for your phone call at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Maria wants to know, what are the rules for extraordinary ministers of Holy Communion?
Well, there are going to be rules that are particular to your parish that are going to be set by your pastor, right?
Okay.
The important thing is that, first of all, that extraordinary ministers would need to be Catholics in good standing with non-scandalous lives, with respectable lives, who are known for their fidelity to church teaching and their personal piety and belief, who will obviously reverence the Blessed Sacrament and are willing to, have some discretion about maintaining the discipline of the sacraments. So, you know, if somebody were to present themselves for communion, for example, that was where the pastor had indicated this person was maybe, you know, excommunicate or in some sort of state of flagrant public sin, and had given instructions, you know, we're not going to give Holy Communion to that individual. You'd have to be willing to do that. And occasionally you're faced with circumstances like somebody may show up in line with a pyx. And that's the sort of small, round, golden case that you use to preserve the Blessed Sacrament.
Yes.
And if you don't know this person, and you don't, you know, they may not have been authorized by the church to be a extraordinary minister of Holy Communion, to take communion to the sick or something. You're not going to be handing out communion willy-nilly and saying, here, just take this host and take it in your pocket and go do what you want with it. No, we're not going to do that. You know, you're not supposed to walk away with an unconsumed host unless you have been specifically designated for that. And generally, the procedure there is to place the pyx on the altar during the consecration, not to come up during communion and demand extra hosts. You know,
yeah,
so you have to make calls like that. And every once in a while, you might catch somebody desecrating a host. That has happened. I mean, I've known personally of cases where someone will receive Holy Communion and then pop a host in their pocket and walk out the door. And you don't know, they may be up to some sacrilegious purpose.
Yeah.
And I know of an extraordinary minister who chased a guy down one time and demanded that he consume that host on the spot and not walk out the door with it, right? Probably one of the most heroic acts that I think I am aware of a minister of Holy Communion. This was a fellow who was authorized to take communion to the sick. And this fellow's dead now, but he took communion to a nursing home and was distributing communion to a person who had dementia and was somewhat feeble-minded. And the individual had difficulty swallowing. And so a piece of host, kind of in a globule of saliva, got stuck to this woman's face, and she wasn't in a frame of mind to take it and consume it herself. And this dear and wonderful soul went over there and took that host off of that woman's face and consumed it himself.
Wow.
You know, which you just picture
humbling.
The scene. Yeah, very, you know, but I
very
mean, he was kind to her and didn't make her feel bad at all, and also respectful of the Blessed Sacraments. I mean, what a stand-up guy to do a thing like that, you know?
Yeah.
And then in spite of popular practice, you're not a priest, and so you're not authorized to give out priestly blessings.
Right.
And everybody, you know, and his brother, and especially his children, comes up and demands that you bless them if they don't intend to receive communion. And you'll often see extraordinary ministers doing what they should not do, which is to mimic the gesture of a priest and give out a priestly blessing. And the best approach to that I've ever heard of was a priest of our diocese who looked over and noticed his extraordinary minister doing this, and he kind of wagged his finger and said, "Tisk, tisk, tisk, buddy, you're shooting blanks." You know?
Love
so
that.
Follow
yeah.
the church's teaching, respect the dignity of the pastor as the ordinary minister of Holy Communion and the distinction between clergy and laity.
Maria, thanks so much for your question there. It is Call to Communion here on EWTN on this Tuesday afternoon. Hope it's not too overwhelmingly hot. I think this is kind of a national heat wave that we're going through right now, David. It's just crazy.
Well, you know, this morning I was actually walking into the network. I had to walk across the black asphalt, you know, to get into the network. And it reminded me of days in Alabama and Georgia and the Southeast when I was a kid and going to, like, the amusement park, like Six Flags Over Georgia.
Sure, sure.
And standing out there with my tennis shoes melting into the pavement, you know, while waiting to ride some roller coaster, while slurping down some, like, artificial blue-colored drink, you
something.
Know, filled with ice, you know,
yeah.
And this sticky, sweaty, melting thing going on, you know. And I thought, yeah, this kind of feels like childhood in Alabama back, you know, back in the day.
Sure, sure, sure. We're going to continue here with an email from Stephen. Stephen says, how did Melchizedek serve as a priest?
I'm not quite sure. I understand the words. I'm not quite sure I understand the difficulty that you have. You know, this is long before the institution of the Levitical priesthood.
Yeah.
So I mean, this is a much more primordial expression of priesthood. I mean, priesthood is just simply someone who's been designated as an intermediary who's authorized to offer sacrifices to Almighty God on behalf of the people, and that's an office that exists outside of Judaism. I mean, it's existed in practically every culture of the world, sometimes more or less superstitiously, but nevertheless, it's a perennial part of human culture. And you know, St. Thomas would consider the impulse to religion a natural virtue. And so Melchizedek was someone who had the natural inclination, even as Abel did, right? In after Adam and Eve were expelled from the Garden of Eden, offering sacrifices to God is something that's gone on literally since Eden, right? And it was only in Israel that office became restricted to a particular family, you know, namely the Levitical priesthood and the tribe of Aaron. He was a person who offered sacrifice to God, particularly bread and wine, interestingly, which is prefiguring the Eucharist, obviously. And he becomes an archetype of Christ because it's someone to whom Abraham pays the tithe, according to the book of Hebrews. Mm. And so Abraham is greater than all of Israel in that they are in Abraham. And yet here is Abraham reverencing Melchizedek, whom he seems to have served as a kind of, vassal to Melchizedek's suzerainty.
Okay. Hey, thanks so much for your email, Stephen. And here's a question as we're going to break here from Jennifer. Can any Christian consecrate the Eucharist in an emergency?
Why? Nope.
And finally, why only baptism?
Yeah, right. So, obviously, Christ could have set things up differently. He didn't. All right?
Okay.
The Eucharist is, first and foremost, a sacrifice. And we were just talking about the intrinsic connection of priesthood and sacrifice.
Uh-huh.
And so having a priestly class is part and parcel of the Eucharistic sacrifice, whereas baptism is not a sacrifice. It's not a sacrifice. And it is foundational to Christian identity in a way that, I mean, the Eucharist is foundational in a way, but there's a different kind of foundation in baptism in that it's literally what makes you to be inserted into the body of Christ. And so it's Christ himself who baptizes in the person of the celebrant. Our explanations are a little bit post hoc because we receive these traditions from Christ and then we try to make sense of them, right? So
yeah.
I mean, it is the practice of the church from antiquity that only priests can consecrate, but anyone can baptize potentially. And we have to try to work to make sense of that.
Jennifer, thanks so much for your question. Hey, there's still time for your phone calls here at EWTN's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Call to Communion on this beautiful Tuesday afternoon here on EWTN. Stay with us. It's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders here on EWTN. Still time for your phone call at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Hey, congratulations going out to another great EWTN radio partner celebrating 7 years with us, the great Armor of God Catholic Radio. They have three stations serving Kepner, Cameron, and Temple, Texas. Congratulations to Tom and Anne Marie McNew and their wonderful team there at Armor of God Catholic Radio from your friends here at EWTN. And they are wonderful, wonderful people. Very glad that you're providing that radio apostolate for all of us. Here's an email now from Nancy. She says, my parish tells me that in order to get married in the church, my fiancé, who was previously married outside the church, must get an annulment. But his wife, his ex-wife, doesn't approve, saying it will stress their children. What should we do?
Get the annulment.
Yeah.
Nothing for it. Yep. Nothing for it. I mean, you cannot marry a man who is married to someone else.
Yeah.
And so that he may not have been married to that person. That's what annulment would find. If it's a verdict of nullity, that means the church declares that the relationship they had did not rise to the standard of a Catholic marriage.
Yeah.
And that is often the case because people don't understand what the church means by marriage, and mm-hmm. our culture doesn't help us. And so people pledge themselves to some kind of relationship, but it ain't marriage. It ain't what the church means by marriage. And so it's not difficult to find grounds for nullity. But, you know, you can't be a judge in your own case. You can't just declare to the church, well, you know, I decided I'm not really married after all, right? No, you've got to submit that to an impartial tribunal that understands what the criteria are that can evaluate whether or not you were in fact married. Now, if they come back and say, yeah, you were married, then you can't get married. I don't think that'll happen in your case. I mean, you've obviously gotten encouragement to do this, which means that the pastor in your case thinks that there's a reasonable expectation they're going to find for nullity, but you still have to go through the process. They are not unfamiliar. Marriage tribunals are not unfamiliar with the non-cooperative spouse. So have a conversation with your pastor about this.
Yeah. The ex-spouse does not have to cooperate.
Right. That's true.
So just leave it right there. Nancy, thanks so much for your email. Hope that's helpful for you. Matthew sent us this one. In Luke's gospel, in the agony of the garden, it says that the disciples were a stone's throw away from Jesus. Who could have heard him speak in the garden?
That's a good question. So as to how the disciples knew the words of Christ, we are left to speculation, right? So perhaps they overheard him. Perhaps he recounted the story to them after the resurrection.
Could be. All right, very good. And thank you so much for that email. Here's one now from Richard. How can the souls in purgatory rise if they are stuck there?
They're not stuck there. They get out. Everybody gets out of purgatory. Eventually.
May take a while.
Yeah, it might take a while. Everybody gets out. They're not stuck.
Richard, thanks so much for your email. And here's one now from Patricia. What is the proper response for Catholic lay people when they come across clergy that seem to be living in error?
Don't go to that guy for confession.
Okay.
Maybe don't take his pastoral advice, or better yet, don't go to him for pastoral advice. Pray for that individual. If you have the right disposition and you're morally strong enough, maybe befriend that individual. It's not your job personally to correct the errors of the clergy. There is such a thing as admonishing the sinner, and the rule of thumb is you admonish a sinner if the matter is grave, if the person is likely to listen, and if you're the best person to make the admonition. Generally speaking, when it's a matter of the clergy misbehaving, unless you have a close personal relationship with this individual, it's hard for me to imagine that this clergyman, is A, going to listen to you, and B, that you are the person best suited to make the admonition. Honestly, the person best suited to make the admonition is his bishop, right? That he's the best, that or maybe one of his brother priests.
Yeah.
Okay. But again, that goes to the question of relationship. If you have a close relationship and the person, individual, trusts you, you know, you might be able to say something. But, I've been around clergy for a long time now, and like everybody else, they're human beings. And all of us get kind of wedged into our little ideological nooks. And we have a way of compartmentalizing and categorizing the people that are likely to criticize us.
Uh-huh.
That makes us deaf to their appeals. You know, oh, she's just one of those blah-bitty-blah-bitty-blahs, you know, whatever that category is. And then whatever you say just goes in one ear and out the other, because they don't have to take you seriously because you're one of those people, right? whatever those people is in this instance, right? And that's just real hard to penetrate. It's hard, you know, I get that way. You know, I mean, there are people who I'm disposed not to listen to on the face of it because I've, you know, they may be associated with some group or something that I don't respect. And so I'm prejudiced at the outset. And it would really take a kind of an extraordinary individual to pierce my own veil of self-assurance. I mean, I have been in that situation. And sometimes I get the veil pierced, but other times I've, you know, maybe years later, I look back and go, my gosh, that person was right. I really was a jerk, you know. Man, I wish I could have listened to good counsel.
Mm.
I'll give you an example of that. You know, my wife was went through a kind of a health nut period early in my children's lives, and she happened upon this kind of health guru who'd written a book, you know, about how to stay healthy and made house on a kind of nutritional advice and so forth. And she was a real enthusiast, you know, real ideologically committed and kind of beating everybody over the head with the book. And I wanted nothing to do with it. And I was like, keep that book away from me. You know, I'm totally not interested. And he seems like a quack, you know. And then, I don't know, 10 years later, I went through my own health crisis and had a doctor, like, turn me on to a particular mode of healthy living and eating that sort of radically transformed my life. And then I went back one day and found on the bookshelf the book that my wife had been beating me over the head with that I wanted nothing to do with. And I read it, and I was like, oh, it was pretty good stuff. It's not so bad. After all, I should have listened to my wife.
Yeah, well.
But, you know, I mean, prophet hath no honor in his own home, neither does a dietary reformer.
Well, there you go. Patricia, thanks
so
much.
You know why the vegan crossed the road?
Why did the vegan cross the road, David?
To tell you that he's a vegan.
Oh, man. That is so good. That's so good. Patricia, thanks so much for your email. Barbara's watching us on YouTube this afternoon. Barbara says, as a convert to Catholicism, what do I say to a good longtime friend who wants to share things about the coming rapture without offending and offering peace?
Yeah, thanks. So, you know, typically what I do in these situations is, to be honest with you, I don't handle them very well. I'm going to tell you what I'd like to say that I do in these situations.
Okay.
In my idealized perfect self-image when I'm not being honest with myself, I'd like to think that I smile benignly and change the subject, right?
Mm.
And because, you know, people don't take nicely to when you sort of burst the bubble of their most cherished convictions, right? It takes a lot to get somebody unwound from around a deeply held ideological conviction, right? And there's a phenomenon that psychologists have identified as resistance, and it's when you tell someone that they know they need to hear, right? You give someone advice that they already know to be true. Even then, the very fact that you give them the advice predisposes them to double down and resist you, right? It's just hard to penetrate. So my initial gut impulse is like to try to just constantly go back to the areas of commonality and goodwill. And really encourage, because, you know, people can be wrong about their eschatology and still live virtuous and charitable lives, you know. And true friendship is a collaboration in virtue, right? It's genuinely willing one another's good and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would want to be able to be friends with this person while agreeing to disagree, right? I will sometimes get righteously indignant and, like, go full-bore apologist on them, right? In my 20 plus years of being a Catholic, how often has that worked? You know, when it was polemical and kind of an attack on their position, never.
Never.
You know, have I brought people to the Catholic faith through open dialogue? Yes, I have. More than once, of course.
Yeah.
But it generally proceeds from a position of trust and openness and friendship and vulnerability, where they end up asking me questions about my Catholic faith, right?
Right.
When I've sort of led with the frontal assault, that's rarely successful. So much better is to lead with love and good character, and make the beauty and truth of the Catholic faith evidence on your countenance, such that this individual may end up asking you about your Catholic. And that's what Peter says, you know, in his epistle. He says, always be ready.
Yes.
Always be ready to give an answer to those who ask you for the hope that's in you. He doesn't say always be ready with, you know, with 10 answers that you can pull out of your pocket to beat them over the head with to convince them that they're wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. Barbara, thanks for watching us on YouTube this afternoon. I must admit, David, do you know what I thought of when you said phenomenon?
Tom, I've read your mail, man.
Okay. Call to Communion here on EWTN. You know what? You should check, if you haven't already, you should check EWTN's Podcast Central. One of the great ones there is called Let Me Be Frank. Is that a pun or a play on words? Well, kind of. It features the Most Reverend Frank J. Caggiano. He is the Bishop of Bridgeport, Connecticut. This is a great podcast. Each episode featuring Bishop Frank's honest opinions about recent Catholic news, reflections on Sunday's gospel, questions from diocesan faithful, and frank discussions of topics of faith and Catholicism. It's a great one. Let Me Be Frank. You can hear this and other faith-filled podcasts at EWTN's Podcast Central. Visit EWTN.com/radio, and then click on the words Podcast Central today. You'll see those words Podcast Central in the upper right corner of the screen. Call to Communion here on EWTN. We can still get a few more phone calls in at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Scott sent us this email. What would happen if Adam and Eve had not sinned? Would Jesus still exist?
Thank you very much. It's a great question. So this one actually occupied the speculations of medieval theologians. If Adam and Eve had not fallen, would there have been an incarnation? Would the second person of the Trinity have assumed human flesh? And not surprisingly, you get two different points of view on this, both yes and no.
All right.
So St. Thomas Aquinas, who's a pretty eminent fellow in Catholic theology, believed that had Adam and Eve not sinned, there would not have been an incarnation, because the only grounds for the incarnation given to us in Scripture are the redemption of the human race. It's not stated that Christ became incarnate for any other reason other than to redeem the human race. However, it was John Duns Scotus's opinion, the blessed John Duns Scotus, that the good of the incarnation, the union of the divine and human in Christ, is such a boon to the human race and human nature, such an intrinsically good thing, irrespective of sin and redemption, that Christ would have been incarnate even if there had been no fall. Who's right? Who knows? But those are the opinions of, well, the Church's most eminent theologian and one of the Church's most eminent Franciscan theologians.
Yeah, absolutely. Here's a question now from Justin. How can we know that 1 Thessalonians 4:17 does not prove that there will be a rapture?
Because it says absolutely nothing about the Protestant doctrine of the rapture. Not one stick about the Protestant doctrine of the rapture. 1 Thessalonians 4 says we're caught up in the air at the return of Christ and that we'll be with him forever. Every Catholic believes that.
Yeah.
That's not what's at issue, right? The rapture doctrine is not, are we caught up in the air with Christ to be with him forever? That's not the rapture doctrine of the Protestant Church. It's much more involved than that. What the dispensationalist Protestants believe is that we will be caught up in the air, not at the second coming, at the end of time, but a kind of secret coming that's nowhere mentioned in the Bible, that there's a third coming of Christ that Scripture doesn't acknowledge or speak to, whereby believers will be zapped out of the space-time universe, carried off to heaven, during which time bowls of wrath will be poured out on the human race in 7 years of great tribulation, after which time Christ and the elect will come back to earth to defeat evil and reign from Jerusalem on a physical throne for 1,000 years, during which time all of the historic promises, literal promises to Israel, will be literally fulfilled in terms of national borders and, you know, goats and bulls being sacrificed on a temple in Jerusalem and camels laden with incense and gold being carted into Jerusalem. All that stuff from the prophets is going to happen in that millennium. And most offensively, the resumption of sacrifices in the Jewish temple, which were forever obviated by the sacrifice of Christ, and so that's blatantly unbiblical position and one that really denigrates Jesus' sacrifice. Not to mention a whole raft of ancillary beliefs about the relationship of the Testaments as well as the meaning of the Gospels and so forth. So there's just a lot of apparatus involved in the Protestant doctrine of the rapture other than the belief that we're caught up in the air, which is something that Catholics believe because the Bible teaches it.
Well, there you go. Hey, thanks so much for your question there, Justin. We do appreciate that. Larry offers us this question. Did chaos already exist prior to Lucifer's sin?
Did chaos exist prior to Lucifer's sin? Depends on what you mean by chaos. So if you mean formless matter, you could make the case that, you could make a very strong case from the exegesis of Genesis that Genesis doesn't actually begin at creation ex nihilo, which is a Catholic doctrine that God created everything out of nothing, but that the story, that there's a creation out of nothing, and then that the story sort of picks up in Genesis 1, where God takes what was otherwise formless matter that he would have pre-created, as it were, and now shapes into the form of creation. And I'm not making that argument, but I'm saying a person could make that argument exegetically. In fact, there's, you know, Jewish commentators from the Middle Ages commented on exactly this fact, that the Genesis 1 and 2 seem to imply the shaping of a pre-existent formless matter, which we would know from other grounds had been pre-created by God, as it were. Now, you know, Catholics often bring an Aristotelian metaphysics to bear on our doctrine of creation, in which formless matter is identified with something called prime matter. It's pure potentiality without any form impressed upon it. And God at the other end of that metaphysical continuum is what we call pure actuality. Mm. And so creation is a matter of God first bringing forth the capacity for being formed, namely prime matter, and then shaping it to some definitive characteristic, namely, you know, his act of impressing intelligible forms upon concrete particulars. So I think you could construct a Christian cosmology that allowed for the possibility of a chaotic unformed matter prior to the act of shaping it into this physical cosmos. And would that have taken place before or after the fall of Lucifer? I mean, this is an entirely speculative hypothesis here, right? So, I mean, what the church teaches is that the fall of Lucifer took place before the formation of the earth as we know it. Right.
Yeah.
And it leaves unanswered some of these other metaphysical questions about how exactly did creation ex nihilo happen? What is the relationship between form and matter and temporality? I mean, those are all things you could play with philosophically, but they're not really the subject of Catholic dogmatic teaching.
Larry, thanks so much for your email. Here is James now in Florida watching us on YouTube this afternoon. James, what's on your mind today, sir?
Hey, I know we're towards the end of the show, so I'll just try to make it real quick. It's a little bit lengthy, probably, of a conversation for another time. But basically, I was coming across some Protestants online, and one Protestant made the charge that Origen actually taught against praying to the saints directly. And the Protestant also was mentioning how he confirms that the saints are aware of us, that they do pray for us. But if you look at some pre-Nicene fathers like Origen, I think he said on his book on prayers, I'm not even sure if that's what the writing is called. He was just basically saying in general that Origen taught you can't pray to the saints. So I just wanted your feedback on that, if you guys don't mind.
Thanks. I would love to dialogue with the Protestant that wants to treat Origen as an authority for Christian belief and practice. And if he would like to go all the way with Origen and become an Originist in every stretch of the imagination, I would be just deliriously happy, right? I mean, Origen is so far removed from anything remotely resembling historic Protestantism that I am just tickled pink that he would quote Origen as an authority. Let's just go in with both feet and do whatever Origen says, okay? Shall we do that, right? You know, before we even examine the question of saints, right? So the the practice of venerating the dead is pre-Christian, and it is in fact Jewish and Judahite, meaning you can find archaeological evidence of it in pre-Judaistic Judah, right? After the Assyrian conquest, from that period of archaeological history, you can find evidence of a cult of the dead in Judah. It's Elizabeth Block, I'm trying to remember her full name, wrote a book a number of years ago on Judahite burial practices where you can see some of the archaeological evidence for that. The practice obviously continues in the Maccabean period, and sacrifices for the dead are in evidence in 2 Maccabees. Belief in their intercession for us also in 2 Maccabees. The angel's intercession, you can see that in the book of Tobit. All this is Maccabean. Christ alludes in a very indirect way to this practice when he rebukes the Pharisees, not for venerating the dead, but for failing to imitate the virtues of the dead whom they venerate. When he says, you know, you decorate the tombs of the martyrs, but you yourself are like the bones inside these unwashed, you know, tombs inside. That's your inner life is characterized by that kind of chaos. But he doesn't criticize the fact that they engage in acts of ritual devotion towards the dead. He criticizes their lack of moral conformity. And Joachim Jeremias, he's a Protestant biblical scholar, wrote a whole book on that one verse where Christ talks about venerating the tombs of the martyrs of the Old Covenant. And it's called, I think it's called Holy Graves in Ancient Judaism, although it's only in German. It's like, I forgot the German titles, you know, Heiligen Grabe or something. So there's that evidence. And then you find evidence of venerating the relics of the martyrs very early in the tradition. So the martyrdom of Polycarp, which is an early second century martyrology, one of our earliest martyrologies, gives witness to the practice of gathering up and venerating the bones of the martyrs. And what we know from archaeology is that the earliest Christian churches, the actual physical buildings, were built on the site of the tombs to martyrs that were venerated in ancient Christianity. And the practice was so ubiquitous that you don't find a strand of the Christian tradition without it. And so archaeologists will track the progress of Christianity in the ancient world by tracking the progress of the relic cult. It is true that the church fathers engaged in more ample theological analysis after the Council of Nicaea. I mean, there's development all across the board, right? In all kinds of doctrines after Nicaea, including the veneration of the martyrs. But when St. Jerome, who is a post-Nicene character, to be sure, but when he looks at this as commentary, does the Bishop of Rome do wrong when he offers the sacrifice of the Mass over the bones of Peter and Paul, but not the Bishop of Rome only, but all the bishops throughout the world? Again, pointing to the ubiquity of the practice, right? And, you know, one thing that we do know from the 4th century post-Nicene fathers is they were sticklers for tradition. And so when Augustine argues with Pelagius about original sin, for example, he says, well, you know, I'm going to advert to the church's longstanding practice of baptizing infants. Because the church baptizes infants, we must conclude that they need to be baptized, that namely they have original sin, right? It's not like Augustine to accept a practice that isn't ancient, that's novel, you know? More fundamentally, again, let's take your Protestants' criterion. Namely, if something is absent from the pre-Nicene fathers, we should jettison it. I wrote an entire article on this thesis and applied it to Protestants. You can find it at the Call to Communion website.
Okay.
And my thesis was, okay, let's run with that, shall we? If you can't find it in the pre-Nicene fathers, let's not do it. Okay, Protestant, that's what you believe? That's what you believe? Great. You know what you can't find in the pre-Nicene fathers ever? you can't find the Lutheran doctrine of justification by faith alone through the imputed righteousness of Christ. That doctrine that Luther said was the article on which the church stands or falls, you cannot find it in the pre-Nicene fathers. You cannot find it in the post-Nicene fathers. You cannot find it in the early medieval theologians. You cannot find it in the high medieval theologians. You can't find it in Bernard of Clairvaux. You can't find it in the scholastics. You can't find it in the medieval mystics. You can't find it blooming anywhere until you find it in Martin Luther, who was a radical innovator. So let's hold to that doctrine. I'm with you 100%, Mr. Protestant. If you can't find in the pre-Nicene fathers, don't do it. That means you have to throw out everything of your own tradition that you can't find in the pre-Nicene fathers.
Wow. There you go, James. I think you got on a roll there. That was awesome.
I got on a roll.
You really did. James, thanks so much for your call from Florida. Great way to end the show. Dr. David Anders, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Tom.
You can take a breath now. It's okay. There you go. Don't forget, we do this program Monday through Friday here on EWTN, 2 p.m. Eastern. Check out the podcast on the aforementioned Podcast Central anytime by going to EWTN.com/radio. Look for the words Podcast Central. On behalf of our fantastic team, I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Anders. Thanks for joining us. See you tomorrow on the Wednesday edition of Call to Communion. Until then, God bless.